Hi, good evening. I'm Yaakov Katz, a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute, and welcome to another episode of our Inside Look at Israel's War Against Hamas, an update on everything that's going on with this war. This evening, we have a very interesting conversation that I recorded earlier this morning with former Major General, retired General, Yom Tov Samia, who used to serve as the commander of IDF's Southern Command, as well as of the Gaza Division. So he's intimately familiar with the ongoings in Gaza, as well as the security situation that he recommends, which should exist there the day after. Lots of talk right now, as we all know, about a potential security zone, a buffer, what that means, how it would look. A very interesting conversation with Yom Tov. And then we're going to talk to Robert Newfield, retired colonel in the IDF, senior fellow at JPPI and an expert on international law, about some of the distinction that's been going on, or the way that the IDF has been operating of late inside Gaza. And we're also joined by Donna Luzon, another fellow at JPPI, a TV host and commentator, which I want to talk to both Donna and Robert also about the conflicting interests sometimes when it comes to the conflict. On the one hand, the continued ground offensive, which, according to various reports, might be actually kind of winding down to some extent. But at the same time, we cannot forget that there still are about 130 hostages who are still being held in Gaza. Before we get to Robert and Donna, though, here first is the interview, a bit lengthy, I might say, for what we usually do with retired General Yom Tov Samia. We are almost 78, almost 80 days into this war. And there are lots of questions of how much time Israel has on the ground in Gaza. You know Gaza probably better than 99% of the Israeli people from the years that you spent there as an officer and as the head of the Southern Command. I'm curious for your analysis of, A, how is the war proceeding in terms of accomplishing its objectives? And two, how much time do you think Israel has left for this ground offensive?
Thank you for having me here with you. I'll start with your second question, which is unfair question, not from you, yes, I mean worldwide. When a country, which is the only democratic country in the Middle East, which is the iron, the shield of the democratic world in Europe and in the United States and for the all Jewish people worldwide, why time is a key? Mm-hmm. We're talking about history. We're talking about 4,000 years of history. We're talking about 2,000 years in diaspora. We are talking about only 75 years old country. Why time is an issue? I'm asking you as an American, assume someone would come to you during your civil war and tell you, listen, you have limited time. Once you finish, whatever you finish until the end of November, we don't care. You're not going to be United States of America. You're going to stay at two different flanks, those against those, etc., etc. And this is your brothers. Here we are talking about Hamas, ISIS, crazy people. Why the hell any country in the world, even the superpower of the United States, which I really appreciate, why the hell time is a question? This is one. Second, I think, and I know a bit of army history and wars history. I searched a lot of wars. I have been in the United States in Fort Benning, Columbus, Georgia for a year, and in other. This war is very different and spatial by two or three means. One, the enemy. The enemy is not a country. There is no state behind them. The enemy is a terror organization, organizations, Hezbollah as well, who the last to care of for them is their people. So we at the West should understand, and I'm happy that I know the Muslim culture. As you said before, my parents came from Libya. I grow up. My first language is Arabic. So I know the culture. I know the way. We, or the Western way is leaders and governments serves their people. In their side, it's the opposite. The service should come from the people. The people are the shield of the government, not the other way side.
Right.
So one is that the kind of the enemy. The second, which is very special, I don't know any other war ever that someone is fighting others who is a terror organization, not a state, while the other one is holding 241 hostages, include kids, six months old, okay, and 85, 87 years old women and ladies on the wheelchairs. It's abnormal. And they are holding them in hidden places. No visit of the Red Cross, no visit of the United Nations. No one knows anything about those hostages, even during the exchange that we made by releasing some of their prisoners, and they released some of those hostages. We didn't know the final names until the last minutes. Even the Red Cross didn't know. They just pushed 10 people to his car and sent them to us like packages. So this is the second issue. And the third, for us at least, the brutal attack on October 7th was against kids, women, kibbutzim, villages, slaughtering people, raping women, cutting. I don't know what even, I can't even talk about what they did. And
terrific things. Yeah.
Yeah. And terrific, crazy things, which no one in the normal world can think about. So those three keys issues making this war very special. And I'm connected that to your first question, or the second, which I answer first. After those three special circumstances around this war, why the hell time is a key issue? Because there is Christmas, because there is vacation in the United States or elsewhere, because there is election in the United States or elsewhere. I don't give a damn on all this, with all the respect. And I'm a religious guy. But with all the respect to the religion, they attack us on Simchat Torah. They attacked us on Yom Kippur. Who the hell is counting holidays on the other side? So please, United States, we are good friends. The relationship between Israel and the United States is a strategic relationship. The roots of this relationship goes back 200 years and more. So please be patient. Let us do the work. We must finish this war with the three main objectives. Release the all hostages. Vanish the Hamas from the Gaza Strip, which I'm talking about it since 2006. Mm-hmm. You can find a lot of videos with me, a lot of interviews.
I do, and we'll get to that in a moment. We'll get to that.
Crazy one. Yeah. Yeah. You said in 2006 and 2008 and 2010 and 14 and 18 and 19, no one will do the work for us. We have to vanish Hamas, and we have to vanish Hezbollah in the north.
Wait, but before that, you said three things. One is get back the hostages, vanish Hamas, and third?
The third is cutting. I believe we talked about this in the past. I don't know if with you guys, but in many other occasions, cutting the Sinai Peninsula from Gaza Strip or Egypt from Gaza Strip. Most of the weapon, the stuff, and the money comes through the tunnels under what we call the Philadelphia border, or the site we call Lion, which is the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. So There are their tunnels, which I spoke last week with a journalist from New York Times. She told me that 6 or 8 years ago, Hamas drove her with a car from Egypt to Gaza through those tunnels. Not a narrow car, with something she told me, it looks like a hammer, means very wide tunnels between.
So, Egypt. Yom Tov, though, you talk about banishing Hamas. I mean, what does that mean? Because we've seen now Israel on the ground in Gaza for about 60 days. It's slow. It's specific. It takes time. There are casualties on our side, sadly, every morning. We're talking Thursday. We wake up, 3 more soldiers were killed. We get that push notification every morning at 6 a.m. There's price on our side. There's casualties on the other side. They're already talking about 20,000 people. The Americans are asking us to stop. But put aside the Americans, can we do it operationally? Is it possible to achieve with military means?
You know, as Bill Maher says in Real Time with Bill Maher every Friday night, which I admired him and his program. He said there is very simple step to stop all that. Hamas to stop fight against Israel. A very, very simple.
Right.
But they don't even think about it. So I'm very sorry about the casualties on both sides. Of course, mainly the innocent people, but war is a war. When I said in 2008, we must banish Hamas. And then in 2014, I was already a civilian as a deputy commanding in reserve in 2000. I left the army in 2001, by the way, but I did reserve duty until 2015. And when I said in 2014, we must banish Hamas, some of the army headquarters, chief of staff, Benny Gantz and other, they says it will cost us 300 casualties. Now, where are we? Very close to 2,000 in our side. 2,000. 1,400 of them are innocent civilian kids who were partying in the Nova festival.
Yeah,
they've been slaughtered. Like in the Holocaust, even with the brutal things that we see here. So the sooner we will vanish Hamas, we will have less casualties in the future. And about your question, vanish Hamas, we cannot kill ideology, okay? But we can clean up the Gaza Strip from weapons, from any arm. And if they want to live a real civilian life, they are more than welcome. Then I would like to see United States, the European Union, China, Russia, whomever is calling us now to help Gaza, come and do a Marshall Plan, build Gaza again, but no more Hamas, no more unofficial guns. One rule, one flag, one gun.
What are the, there's a lot of talk right now about what we call in Hebrew an Ezor Chayitz, or a buffer zone between the Israeli kibbutzim along the border.
Great question.
And Gaza, when we start to pull out and go from the high intensity stage to the lower intensity stage. The Americans aren't so excited about this. They want to see Israel pull all its troops out of Gaza. But how important is this buffer zone? Could you explain to our listeners who probably don't understand what this means and what the strategic importance or tactical importance is of it? You obviously would know.
Okay. As you said before, I was the commander of the Gaza Strip, the division commander of the Gaza Strip from Madrid to Oslo in general, which is from summer 1991 until the end of 1993. It was the most tough period of terrors. Include the rising of Hamas and Jihad Islami and Fatah at that time as well. And if we can connect it to this guy behind my back.
I was going to ask you who he is. Yeah.
Okay, so let's connect it to this period, because I met him first time in this period. His name is Ori Azulay. He born and raised in Kiryat Shmona. He's one of the best officers I met ever. He came to my division when I was a brigadier general and he was first lieutenant. I fall in love in his leadership. And I begged him to join him as a soldier in his troop when we were working undercover, pretending to be Muslims and Arabs and going into the markets inside Gaza, inside Khan Yunus and other area. So unfortunately, he became after that a company commander in the paratroopers and was killed in Lebanon in 1996. And since then, his picture is in my offices, wherever I'm going, because for me, he's a light of leadership.
Mm, wow.
After that period, at the end of 1993, the chief of staff decided to nominate me as part of the negotiation team in Taba, Cairo, to translate the DOP, the Declaration of Principles from Oslo, to a real agreement. And we were in charge of the security agreement of that part. And we were sitting and traveling from like October 1993 until May 4, 1994, when we signed the agreement in Cairo. I was in charge on the maps. I was in charge on all the security, the joint security operations. Then I became the JSC leader, the joint security leader from the Israeli side. And I drew the maps by my hands. I still have the original here. One day we will sell it on Amazon, probably, of course, for the nation, not for my pocket. And we agreed with the Palestinians for the sake of the security of the Palestinians on two major things, and they are in the agreement. One, the Philadelphia border, which I mentioned before between Gaza and Egypt, is a closed military zone, painted in a red color. It was the only red color area on the map. Okay? Military zone. No one can enter this area and stay alive. And they begged for it. They asked for it. We asked for it, of course, but I was very surprised how Palestinian team support our request, because they knew very well if this border will stay open, Hamas will reinforce himself from Egypt, from the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt, etc. So they said, please do it as a permanent Israeli military zone. In other words, save us from Egypt or from the extremists in Egypt, mean the Ikhwan al-Islamiyya, the Islamic Brother.
Mm-hmm.
This is one area. So, and we agreed that, by the way, even after the midterm agreement, which supposed to be 5 years, even during the permanent agreement, this border will stay under Israeli control. Mm-hmm. Of course, they wanted that the Rafah passage will be under their control, blah, 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 but we didn't agree and they knew it's
in the... So basically, it's still needed today is what you want to say, right?
It's even much more needed
today. Much more needed.
Uh-huh. And the fact that we insist to have it shows you, unfortunately, Ariel Sharon did a big mistake when we pulled out from Gaza. I was 5 years already civilian in 2005.
Right.
And I begged him, okay, you can pull out the settlements. It's your decision. You're a political, you're the
but
leader.
Not the soldiers.
Don't pull the soldiers from the Philadelphia border.
Yeah.
Don't pull yourself in one night like we ran away 5 years ago from Lebanon.
Right.
Don't pull away without coordinating with the Palestinian Authority and stay there as an army post for a few years more to help the Palestinian Authority to be stronger. Unfortunately, he didn't listen to me. He listens to others, include Americans,
right,
include the United States, by the way. So you're not always right, United States of America. We know our problems.
Right.
The second part in this map was the military zone, you call it. It was a dot line, 1 kilometer, 1,000 meters from the fence of today, the border, into the Gaza Strip, which most of it were only agriculture area. And we agreed together that in this, we call it security perimeter of 1 kilometer wide, that no one from the Palestinian side can step to this area. It's agriculture area with a weapon. Israel have the right of hot pursuit. In case something happened on defense, we can do hot pursuit after the terrorists into this area without coordination with the Palestinian Authority. We just have to let them know that we passed the fence and we are running after a terrorist attack. And they, the Palestinian police, cannot enter this military or this security perimeter with weapon. What's happened after 2000, and they kept it, by the way, from 1994 until 2005, give and take, they keep it because it was agriculture area. They didn't have any reason to be there.
In recent years, though, they've gone as close to the fence.
Then 2005, when we pulled ourselves from Gaza, all of a sudden, after one night, the Hamas built their posts there, and first the Palestinian Authority, and then the Hamas.
Right.
And the same, by the way, happened in May 24, 2000, with Hezbollah.
Yeah.
When we ran away from Lebanon with the same mistakes. Okay, on my next book, I have a huge chapter about one-sided steps in the Middle East and the meaning of it.
Interesting.
By a Muslim culture, by an Arab culture, not by a Western culture. Mm-hmm. It is not a border between Netherlands and Belgium. It's not the border between Sweden and Norway, guys. We are living in a much, much different area and regimes around us.
Yom Tov, I want to thank you so much for joining us at JPPI. This is fascinating, and we're going to have you back on the show again because your input and insights is so important. So thank you very much. So that was very interesting, and you know, obviously a bit of a historical review there of how they got it right back then and everything went wrong. But I found it to be very interesting and kind of Yom Tov's perspective. What he spoke about, which I just to make sure that people who were listening understood, is that while he stepped down back in 2001, he stayed on as what you can call the deputy commander of the Southern Command for a number of years. So during Operation Cast Lead in 2008-9 and also during Protective Edge, the big Gaza war of the summer of 2014, he was the number two, or basically the shadow to the commander of the Southern Command. So he was very much intimately involved in planning of the operations as well as the execution, just up until, you know, very recently. Robert, I do want to start with you, though, because one of the things that's come up lately, and, you know, every morning here, and I mentioned this before with Yom Tov, we wake up to those 6 a.m. push notifications with the dead, the soldiers who were killed the day before, telling us who they are, their stories come out. I dread looking at my phone every morning, as I'm sure millions of other Israelis do. But there has been some criticism, and I think it really came out starting last week when there was that tragedy in Sajaiya, in the central Gaza Strip, where there was that big force from Golani and some others, 669 unit, the search and rescue. But people who went into this building, a couple soldiers were caught, more soldiers went into the building was booby-trapped or collapsed, whatever it was that happened. You had about 10 soldiers who were killed that day. And people started to say, why are soldiers going into buildings, right? Why aren't the tanks blowing up the buildings? Why isn't the Air Force blowing up the buildings? Yeah. Now, you've dealt a lot with this in the international legal sphere, but I'm wondering if you could kind of give us just a quick explanation to, obviously a lot of that has to do with politics, you know, right, left, whatever. Let's not get into that. No, people who are saying we should hit harder. But I want you to give us the real answer. What is it that why are we not attacking these buildings? Why are soldiers going in there? The operational and the legal.
Well, first of all, Yaakov, we're attacking a lot of buildings, okay? There's another criticism saying just a different thing about it. But first of all, there's the operational issue here. First, that's the most important one. Well, we have things to look for them, right? We have hostages that we're looking for, and we know they're there. There's information. There are shafts going into underground tunnels. So what the IDF is actually doing is doing what Yom Tov Samia just said. We're trying to eliminate Hamas, find all their assets around there, and it's very difficult job to do. And I'll tell you what, it was urban warfare has always been the worst throughout history. I would say that if you compare the IDF work in Gaza to any other urban warfare throughout history, they're doing a tremendous work with protecting our own soldiers. That's very important. So from the operational way of thinking, they need to be there, they need to enter the buildings, that's one thing. From the legal perspective, there's international law allows forces to act in a very open fire against things that are in their location or their purpose can be dangerous to them. They can act against it. It's not a legal limitation, I think, that is bothering the forces. That's not it. That's not the issue. Actually, international humanitarian law, the laws of war, allow a lot of power for the operating force to implement in order to achieve the military goal. I wouldn't say that's the issue. Of course, you have to, if you know there are civilians there, you need to take this into account. They still can be unfortunate collateral damage, but again, it's something you need to take into account. But I wouldn't think that's the issue that limits them. Hopefully it's not politics or international politics that affect that. At least as the IDF spokesman said, that's not the things that stop the IDF. That's not why they are entering these buildings. And tragedies happen, unfortunately.
Right. Right, but if I just sharpen it for a moment, you're confident that this isn't about like people. I'm just repeating what some of the critics are saying, is that Israel doesn't want to bomb these buildings. They're afraid of the American criticism, things along those lines.
I don't really think that's the issue. I hope it's not the issue. The way I know, I know a bit of the operational. Plans and the way the IDF operates, that will not be the issue that holds the IDF. It's
right.
And you can see there's a lot of footage about what's going on in Gaza, and there's nothing to stop the IDF when it's moving forward. And there's a lot of damage behind it, unfortunate, but that's it.
That is what war is. Dana, the two interests that we spoke about, right? There's the hostages. And there's, of course, the ground offensive. And it seems like, once again, it's coming to a intersection of where the government is going to have to make a decision. What does it do? And I keep on going back to Friday, because if those three hostages who ran out of that building had been rescued in the alternative reality, or the alternate reality that we could imagine for a moment, the whole country would be like, keep going. Right, the ground offensive is working. We're rescuing hostages. It would have showed the world how important the operation on the ground is. Also, although we'll still have critics, people would say, keep going. We're getting hostages.
That it
ended with this tragedy, though,
yeah,
makes I think, it clear that you have no choice but to now make a political deal with Hamas.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that if the tragedy was ending differently. I feel that we know already we have a huge dilemma, and this is a big dilemma because each way you will choose, you are going to pay a big price on it. The cost is very big. But I feel that while we are continuing to fight, I think Israel and the government is trying to protect the country from the outside. But while we are trying to protect the country from the outside, we are breaking us from the inside. And I think they don't see that enough. And there is a contrast between, between the country and the citizens. And while you are not stopping and bringing the hostages back, you are saying, I'm not sure I'm, the country is saying, I'm not sure I'm standing with this contract anymore. And you can't do that while there is a war and you are having hostages. If you want to change the rules and if you want to open the contract between the country and the citizens, do it after the war. And you will have the time issue. You can bring the hostages back now, stop fighting, and start again in a month and even in 2 months. You had so many years to kill Hamas. Now, when they are forcing you to do that, you're saying, now I don't have a choice. But you have a choice, and you need to suggest, and you need to decide to stop, bring them and back. And I'm not mixing what happened, the tragedy with the three hostages. I don't think we need to put this in the story of our decisions. And again, I think the sentence we need to think about, and if I can say that out loud for the country and for the prime minister and who is taking the decisions, while you're trying to protect the country from the outside, you're breaking the country from the inside. And I don't think there is a way back. If they won't bring them back, I don't think the country will be able to handle that. And it will break us down. I'm sure of that.
Robert, I see you have a bit of a smile on your face.
So,
tell me what you're thinking.
I fully appreciate Dana's perspective on this. I need to say that, to my opinion, that tragedy, something that shouldn't have happened. People that are raising white flags, walking outside and without anything on them, and that shouldn't have happened. And I do think you're right in the sense that if this had happened differently and resolved in us bringing hostages, our standing in this negotiation would have been a bit different. The same negotiation also that Dana is speaking about now, and I agree with her, we need to bring them back. I have to say, I have a different perspective as to whether the question is at all price, and it's not all up to us. If I understand correctly, the picture is that we would be happy to give a lot and to bring them all back. The military power, the use of military power is important.
But you're not worried about the time issue. You have time to kill Hamas. You don't have time to bring the hostages.
So I don't think, but again, Yom Tov Samia says who, right, in the question that I asked him also about the time. Who the hell is America to tell us about time, right?
No, I'm not talking about the time of America. I'm talking about the time that we are afraid what will happen to the hostages.
No, that I understand, but you do have, so you could say I have three clocks that are ticking.
Yeah.
Or four clocks. I have the clock of IDF operations, ammunition, soldiers, reserves, how long I can keep them in, all of that, the operational clock. I have the clock of the resilience of Israeli society. I mean, at some point, Israelis will get tired. There's war fatigue. People, families that don't have their loved ones who aren't home, employees, companies that are, you have 300,000 reservists. That's almost 10% of our workforce, not there. That's clock two. Clock three is the hostages. Their clock is ticking. They're being starved. They're not getting medical care. They're being abused. That is a clock as well. But clock four is the clock of the window that we get from the world. Now we could say, like Yom Tov Samia says, I'll paraphrase, go to hell, right? But in reality, it doesn't work that way. And I think we all know that. So therefore, there is the window is not endless to destroy Hamas.
But there is another thing you forgot to put in clock number two. You said in clock number two that the citizens are getting tired. Also, the ones who are fighting and the one who are waiting for their loved ones. But yeah. in that clock, there is something that calls the contract between Israel and the citizens. This is the clock. And if you, what is the message you are sending to your citizens if you are not stopping and bringing the hostages? Why, sorry, this is a very difficult sentence I'm going to say. Why should I stay a citizen in Israel if I know that no one is going to bring me back if I'm being adopted?
Your point is very valid, and you're right. There's yeah. a social contract between the state.
Yeah,
and
of course.
And that was, had it, and
it's
I think-
too difficult.
Had it just been soldiers who were abducted, that would have been one thing. The right away when it's hostages, when it's civilians, sorry, it's another thing. Robert, I want to ask you, just on changing gears for one moment, you were part of a lawsuit or a case that was filed today on behalf of, I think, one or two of the hostages against the
Red Army. More than that. We have plenty of hostages there. Some released, some still there.
Right. Against the International Red Cross. The best description I've heard of them is they are something like a taxi service, right?
Generally, the Red Cross have a very important duty in force, right? According to Geneva Conventions, I'll take, for example, the fourth Geneva Convention, they are mentioned 33 times. Only that convention, because a lot of the things that the parties to the Geneva Convention have to apply to goes with the Red Cross. The Red Cross is the one who's visiting detainees or having contact with the families of those detainees. They have a huge, important role in conflicts. And what we have seen in this particular conflict, I'll say something which is kind of terrible to say. They are reliving what they have done during the Holocaust with the Jews. Exactly the same. They are passive. They are just looking the way out. It's easy to say that, yes, they are not the ones that can force Hamas to visit the hostages, but they did accept the state of Palestine to be a member state to the Geneva Conventions. So why don't you hear about them going to the Palestinian Authority saying, hey, guys, you're paying for Hamas. Where are you? You are obliged to tell them to visit the hostages. You are obliged to release them, that you can't take the hostages at all. That's the first thing you have to do. But at least until they're there, you have to visit them. You have to let us go there. In the first weeks, when after this terrible war started, and we had 240 hostages there, they did absolutely nothing. I'll tell you more than that. We had one family that joined this lawsuit now, that the hostage needed some medicine to be given to him, which is kind of critical. And they went to the Red Cross here and tried to tell them, we need to bring that medicine to that person. And the Red Cross here said, just disregarded them, and so they couldn't do anything. So they flew to Germany because that person has a German passport and met with the Red Cross there, only to be told or send an email. You have to read that email. It's incredible. Saying to them, listen, we forward your appeal to the Israeli Red Cross, to our office in Israel, and we wish you all the best in getting contact with your family.
Amazing.
Incredible. So they flew to the U.S., and in the U.S., they met again with the officers of the Red Cross, and they just disregarded them, and that's it. And that's the story. And this is not what you expect from the major humanitarian party. They have a huge role, and we believe that they have a duty of care for these people. They need to fulfill their duties with due diligence. They need to do something which is like not to be passive and work, and they just miss the whole thing. I hope it's not intentional, but it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. I'll tell you just one side story, not the International Red Cross, but a hostage family that I know was in America and met with a senior politician. And the politician asked the parents, how often do you get to speak to your son who's being held hostage? As if there
he was naive.
As if there are phone calls that go on. And they looked at him, and this is and they were blown away. Like, what are you talking about? We don't talk to him. Like, there's some people as smart as they might be, and as high up as they might be, just don't understand, because they think that there's the International Red Cross that's there and is visiting and is, you know, giving updates.
That's the problem, Yaakov. People just from outside don't understand what we're dealing with. We will not distress and accept anything that you're not doing. We will fight.
Donna, we got 3 more minutes, so I need a quick answer to this question.
Yeah, sure.
You just wrote a piece that appeared on the Walla website, big news Hebrew news website in Israel, about the name of the war. There's a lot of talk of changing the name in Hebrew. It's Charavot Barzel, Swords of Iron, which doesn't roll off the tongue well in English at all, or in Hebrew for that matter. What's this? What are you talking about? Who wants to change the name? Why do they want to change the name? What do they want to change it to?
I think, to be honest, sadly as it sounds, but we said that this is the place to say the truth. So this is the truth, in my opinion. I think Netanyahu wants to change the name because not because it doesn't sound good or it's not catchy, because a name of a war has a huge impact on the society. And I was doing some research, and there is one professor who was investigating the names of the wars. And you know, a name of a war really influences what the citizens are thinking if we are winning, and if this is if we succeed to do what we want to do, did we achieve our goals? And I think he wants to change the name, and this is a political thing. Don't be naive. It's the way to control the minds of the citizens. And I think this is weird to do it now. We are not in the end yet. We still have hostages. We don't know what is the best strategy to continue. The name is the issue. Maybe we need to ask ourselves why. I think I gave a small answer, but I'm leaving it also for you.
This I agree fully with Dana. That's
very interesting.
Is the mere discussion about it at this time? What does it come from? What does it represent?
And
very interesting. Well, I want to thank Dana, Robert, Yom Tov Samia. I want to thank all of you for joining us this week. We will be taking a break as usual for the weekend for Shabbat, and we will be back on Monday and Thursday. We do now twice a week under the new format. So you can catch us on Monday and Thursday. We're available on YouTube. We're available at the JPPI website, and we're available also as podcasts, where podcasts can be found. Have a nice weekend. And to our Christian listeners and viewers, happy holidays to you as well. Thank you all very much.